Keeping faith while in college is quite a challenge today. Of course, it didn't used to be that way. All the great universities, in fact, in America, just about, were founded by Christians for Christian purposes, including Harvard, William & Mary, Yale, Dartmouth, Brown, Princeton, and so on. But today, a Christian student may be lucky to preserve his or her faith, including even at state schools. Recently, a longtime professional counselor, including work among some college students, Dr. Gary Lovejoy, has written a book geared toward helping students preserve their faith in college. The book is called In the Lion's Den. Earlier, Dr. Lovejoy and I spoke about this very topic in a radio discussion, and we'll link to that. But today what we want to do is focus on some examples of Christian answers to objections of faith that students are likely to hear these days. How should we respond? I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point, and our guest, again, is Dr. Gary Lovejoy. And by the way, his website is heartswithpromise.com. Dr. Lovejoy, it's great to have you back on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for asking me to come on. It's a real pleasure.
Oh, sure. Okay, so we've already discussed the overall problem that many students, Christian students, lose their faith. And so now let's talk about what does a student say if the professors allege that, well, there's really no historical evidence to back up Christianity.
Well, yes. They talk about that. They also talk about they accuse Christianity of many things, which really throws students off. But first of all, to say that when they say there is no evidence, the Christian has a lot of opportunities to come back on that, because there is a ton of evidence. And actually, the evidence for Christianity is far better than evidence of almost any other historical event. And the fact that...
Well, certainly of antiquity.
Right. Right. The witnesses that have written about Christianity were within decades of Christ's life. Alexander the Great, which no one questions, but the first real biographies of Alexander the Great were several centuries after his death. And this is true for throughout history of major figures that have led throughout history, which we take for granted. And we assume they are, because the evidence seems overwhelming. But almost every case, because it was a common practice, especially in antiquity, that people didn't write about it until many centuries later, or sometimes at least one or two centuries later. In the case of Christianity, however, those who are witnesses who wrote about it were within a few decades after Christ's death. So it exceeds the requirements of any other historical event. And yet they take the argument that there's not enough, it's after the fact, and it's not accurate, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that even Josephus, who was a contemporary of Jesus, wrote about Jesus' life and his remarkable feats, as he talks about the miracles and all the rest, and he talks about his death and his resurrection. So he was a contemporary. That is almost unheard of in the literature of antiquity. And so there is a great deal of evidence for its support, and the evidence is very powerful. Now, sometimes they make Marxists make a lot of arguments against Christians, and they really prefer to make accusations rather than argue from the historical standpoint, because that is probably one of their weakest arguments.
Wait, before we go down that line, how about, since this is something you bring up in your book, the argument that Jesus claimed to be divine, he claimed to be the Messiah,
yeah.
Okay, that mm-hmm. if you say that he was wrong, okay, fair enough, but then are you implying that he was nuts or that he was a liar?
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, they love to talk, when they talk about Jesus, they say, well, he was a moral teacher of his day, and they're making something more of him than he was. that he was never more than just an itinerant moral teacher. How are you a moral teacher if constantly lying and you're constantly misrepresenting yourself?
Assuming these claims that he was divine are untrue.
Right. And so how can he be a moral teacher at the same time be living an immoral life? Because that's what they're really accusing him of. And because they, and like you said, either that or he's a lunatic. But he can't be considered, if he's considered sane in any sense of the word, then he is misrepresenting. He's a liar. So he's either a liar or a lunatic, according to them. And they are really reluctant to use those terms, because if they're trying to humiliate a Christian, they want to look like they're recognizing the legitimacy of the fact that he was a teacher of some kind. You're just making more of it than you should. If they just said, well, Christ doesn't exist, or Christ never was crucified, which is what the Muslims, by the way, argue, or he was never resurrected, et cetera, there's a ton of evidence to suggest differently. But if they're to argue that, then the historical facts start coming into play, and they become much more impotent in their arguments. However, if you present it in terms of this dilemma that they present, that he's a lunatic or a liar, then it paints them as an ugly, how can I put it, an ugly portrayal of someone who is revered by not just Christians, but even by non-Christians. They think, well, if you talk to them, most Christians say, oh, yeah, who is Jesus Christ? They'll say, well, he was a moral teacher someday, I mean, a long time ago, and he healed a lot of people, and he was a good man. They'll say things like that. Well, the Marxists are not going to alienate those who are not Christians who see him as a good teacher. They're not going to do that, because then they alienate not just the Christian, but half the class. And so so consequently, they have to take a more moderate approach. That's why they attack it from a perspective of Christianity rather than just Christ. If they focus on Christ himself, they fall into all sorts of traps, and which the Christian can clearly exploit. However, most Christians, because they're even being attacked, they are so on the defensive that they have a hard time even thinking. And they are not only not ready to give a reason for what they believe, but they may be ridiculed for believing what they do, but coming up with counter arguments, so to speak, is very difficult for them. And so they fall silent. Instead of actually reasserting their faith, they just fall silent in embarrassment and humiliation.
And you're saying in this book that the best offense, or the best defense, rather, is a good offense. And mm-hmm. why should we be silent? I mean, is the witness of the Christian church throughout the ages, is it so bad? Oh, yeah, okay, there's the Crusades and there's the Inquisition. But you turn things around and say, wait a minute, it was the Christian church that invented hospitals. It was the Christian church that invented the phenomenon of the university around 1200 AD. It was the Christian church that produced all kinds of great, you know, incredible contributions to music and literature, and also even to democratic government and so forth. Dr. Kennedy and I wrote a whole book about this and a follow-up. But the first book was, What If Jesus Had Never Been Born? And the follow-up was, What If the Bible Had Never Been Written? Because these things did happen, because of Christianity, all kinds of ways in which our lives are blessed, including those Marxists who want to, you know, take away people's faith.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's one of the reasons why they go on the offensive, the Marxists, is because if they can succeed in pushing the believer back on his heels, because he's trying to defend against the accusations, then he's in a one down position. The Marxist is in a one up position, and like you said, for example, they may attack. They'll say, "Well, Christianity is responsible for genocide," they may take a maybe a takeoff on a look at the genocide of the Palestinians, and you support the Israelis. It just shows you you are always on the side of genocide. Look at the Book of Joshua and the killing of men and women and children. He says, well, that's genocide, and Christians have really struggled with that. And there are Christians who struggle with that without being challenged on it. Or like you said, you can take the really egregious examples such as the Crusades or the Inquisition. Although there, if that's brought up, I can always talk about the corruption of the church. The medieval Catholic Church became incredibly corrupt. Why? Because they joined government and religion together. They took the first 300 years of Christianity. Christianity was on its own. It spread primarily by word of mouth, by evangelization, the discipleship of the nations, as it were. But after 300 years, once Constantine came to power and decreed that Christianity was that he won his throne by representing Christianity, and it gave them a place at the table. Then it was Theodosius a few years later who then made it the state religion. Once that happened, then there was a merging of religion and of Christianity and the empire, the Roman Empire. And when that happened, Christianity became incredibly corrupted. And that was the reason why we ended up with the Crusades, which were, and if you look at the study of the Crusades, you discover that from the Pope on down, they were preaching heresy. And they had distorted almost all of the early doctrines of the early church.
All right, we have about 3 minutes left. And by the way, I get a kick out of this idea that the Marxists would accuse Christians of genocide. Marxism has the worst track record of all, you know, when it comes to killing millions and millions of people. I have in my office this big, fat, thick book published by Harvard University Press, 1999, The Black Book of Communism. And all it does is it just catalogs the crimes only of the 20th century and only of the communists, not even including the National Socialists, otherwise known as the Nazis.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. They are responsible for a tremendous amount of death and destruction over the years. The Marxists, though, that's one of the reasons why they go on the aggressive side and why they are making these accusations, because once a person is in a defensive position, they may not think of the arguments you're making, and as legitimate as they are. And yes, but they're guilty of almost everything they accuse the church of being.
When they
say, for example, they say Christians believe that everyone is a sinner, and so they breed distrust and hatred toward others. Telling people that and denying that man is inherently good is hate speech. And they also add that it's hypocritical because they fight each other. They have various doctrines and various divisive denominations that fight each other, and they don't look for the good in man. But Marxists express true equity and diversity and look for the goodness of man. That's the kind of thing they will say. And so how does a Christian then counter that? Well, one of the reasons is that they're saying that all men are good or essentially good. This is one reason why they adopt utopian mindset, is that give us the chance to have full control. And you say, well, in the past, Marxism has not been carried out according to genuine Marxist principles. And so there have been people who have corrupted it, like Lenin and Stalin.
And when AOC does it, it'll all be perfect, and Mondami too. We're out of time. Dr. Lovejoy, I could have you on again. Maybe we can talk about some other objections. Your website again is heartswithpromise.com, the name of the book, In the Lion's Den by Dr. Gary Lovejoy. Sorry about the restraints of time. Thank you again for being with us.
Really appreciate having the time to spend with you.